You're listening to Illinois Soul, and this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Welcome. Just like the name of this program, we hope this will be a weekly dialogue about the news shaping Black communities in Central Illinois. Saturdays at 11 a.m. and repeating Tuesdays at 7 p.m., you're going to hear interviews, in-depth stories from the IPM News team about education, health, politics, arts, and more. From time to time, we'll also share excerpts from other programs at Illinois Public Media, like our weekday talk show, The 21st. But first, let's get started this week with University of Illinois Chancellor Robert Jones. We taped this interview in mid-January. Chancellor Jones, thank you for being the first guest on Dialogue, our new program on the new Illinois Soul.
Well, thank you very much, Reginald. It's my great honor and pleasure to be with you today.
So we'll get right into the questions. According to the U of I, the fall semester enrollment of African-American students is about 3,500, and it's a few hundred down from 2021. What makes attracting Black students a challenge at the U of I?
Well, there are a number of reasons that it continues to be a challenge. The main one I would have to say is in part affordability. You know, the fact that unlike some other places that students could go to, that they choose to go to, we are not as competitive as we need to be in terms of full ride offers. And we know this because, as you know, keeping educationally accessible and affordable has been a top priority for me for the last 8 years and continues to be so. But we also know full well there's roughly about 900 or so students that we offer financial aid to, pretty competitive packages, and about 60% of them is because those packages don't cover the full cost of attending. But for about 35-40%, there are other reasons that they don't enroll even after we extend an offer. And I can tell you the numbers are not increasing the way we would like, but it's not because we haven't dramatically increased the number of students that we admit to this university. The data is quite clear that we're admitting more students than we ever have in the history of this university, but we're not able to move the total percentage or the number of students in the direction that we would like to be see it going. So we're doing a deep analysis, and we will continue to spend. We spend about $50 million a year more than we were spending in 2016 when I started here. And we know that we've got to be a bit more aggressive in some of the other areas. We're working as a part of the American Talent Initiative. I am one of the members of the steering committee, and we've been asked to participate in a project that is going to be designed to help about nine other universities around the country demonstrate what can be done with having more seamless transfer from community college. We have some seamless transfer programs now with a number of colleges, but we're looking at how can we ramp the seamless transfer up? How can we make it more seamless for community college students to transfer to the university after their first 2 years in community college? How do we make sure that you get the curriculum aligned so that the transfer credits, that all the credits that they've earned transfer. And so we're working on that as well. You know, we started the Illinois Commitment as a way of keeping education accessible and affordable. That pays for any family making $67,100 or less per year can attend a university tuition free and tuition and fees free.
As you know, last June, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled public and private universities must end race-based affirmative action.
We begin tonight with the Supreme Court striking down affirmative action and reshaping college admissions.
The court's six-justice conservative majority said the schools discriminated against white and Asian American applicants by using race-conscious policies that benefited students from underrepresented backgrounds. Chief Justice John
Will that
Roberts
hurt the university in enrolling black students here?
Well, I won't. I'm certainly not going to sit quietly and hopefully not allow it to hurt. But we are going to have to now more than redouble our efforts to make sure, because on top of the challenges I just mentioned, the SCOTUS decision and other states that have implemented this elimination of affirmative action goals as a part of the admission criteria, like California is the one that comes to top of the mind, saw significant declines in their black and brown students when those decisions were made. So we anticipate that unless there is some real thoughtful efforts put into place, this could potentially further exacerbate our enrollment problems. But let me just say unequivocally, we have never used race as a primary or as the only decision in admitting students. We're one among many universities across this country that has used a multiple variable admission criteria. And race was just one among one of the many criteria that we look at in terms of how do we bring in a diverse student body. But now, since that is no longer going to be allowable, we are thinking about other ways that we can continue to bring in a diverse student body. And I'll be very, very clear here. We always abide by the law. And this is the law of the land now, so we will abide by that SCOTUS decision.
In June of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, you issued a call to action to dismantle racism and injustice. A campus community compact was formed. What have you learned about how the black community who lives in Champaign-Urbana views the U of I, and how will that be changed?
Well, we certainly, I think we all would agree that George Floyd murder, among others, really was a point of change for how many communities, including universities, how many entities, I should say, interface with communities. And certainly that's been the case here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And I think you also know that I spent most of my career in Minneapolis. And so this really did hit home very close to me because I still have a couple of sons and two grandsons that live in that community. And but by the grace of God, you know, one of them could have been victimized in the same way that Mr. Floyd was. And so this is something we care greatly about. And so we issued the call to action to end racism and injustice in society because we feel as a public university and as a land-grant university and as a university that really is very steeped in public and community engagement, that we had an opportunity to step up and to do business as unusual and to redouble our efforts to build stronger, more seamless, impactful relationship with community. And through the work that Dr. Wanda Ward has led through our University Community Compact and through the work Dr. Sean Garrick has led to administer the Call for Action research grants, where we actually provide funding for university faculty in partnership for the most part with folks in the community, are doing what a university is supposed to do. How do you research a problem to find solutions to complex problems? And how that research then potentially could lead to a deeper relationship between the community and the university, as well as creating new opportunities and new programs that will fundamentally address these issues. We started this because we figured that we didn't want to be perceived or to be in any way a part of the problem. And we had an obligation and an opportunity to be part of the solution. And that's why the call to action was initiated. And we just had a meeting this past summer, a standing room only meeting with members in the community. And I tell you, I could not be more proud with the deep partnerships and relationships that we've established with multiple communities, not just the African-American community, but other underserved communities.
You have such a storied history in agriculture. Both your master's degree and doctorate are in crop physiology. How do we get more young black students to think about agriculture either as a science or a business?
Well, first and foremost, you got to kind of help redefine what does agriculture mean. And this has been something I've been dealing with for the better part of my 45 years in higher education. I remember a point in time, probably some 35 years ago, people were almost at the verge of trying to encourage people to stop using the word agriculture. And so now we've come full swing, and with what's going on with urban agriculture, the fact that we're able in many, many cities and urban and not so urban environments, young people and are learning about where food comes from. This is a core strategy of the 4-H entities across this nation. And I happen to serve on the governing board for 4-H nationally. And so food and food systems, urban agriculture, the fact that here at the University of Illinois, ag tech is one of the fastest growing sectors, I think, definitely in the state, if not across the country. And so now, because of all the changes in the infusion of technology into food production, we really do have to this opportunity to redefine and help people understand that agriculture is not a bad word.
And you are also a Grammy Award winner as a member of the Sounds of Blackness. Our new station, Illinois Soul, is all about amplifying Black voices in music. Real quickly, do you have a two or three of your favorite R&B groups that you could name?
Well, I have to say, and not biased about this, one of my favorite groups is the one that you mentioned, the Sounds of Blackness. Because not only am I favorite because of my pleasure to sing with them for 30 years that ended up in the Grammys, but the music that we performed was transformative. It was about message music. It was about getting people to be more inspirational and aspirational. It did the whole gamut of music from African-American music to gospel to R&B to Phil Hollers and that's slave chants, et cetera. So that is, maybe I'm biased, but that is clearly one of my favorite groups, and they're still performing today. But another one is a group that was also signed us at the same time that was called Mint Condition. And Mint is, I think they're still performing, but their lead singer and major songwriter, Stokely, is a young man I've known since he was about probably 8, 9 years old, because he was a member of my church in Minneapolis, and his father was a professor of African and African-American studies at McAllister College that I knew quite well. And so I'm very, very proud of how Stokely has developed his own career as a solo artist. And the last one I have to say is an old school group. And I don't mention this enough. I'm a very strong fan of Kool & the Gang, because my cousin was one of the original members. His nickname was DT, Dennis Thomas. And fortunately, Dennis just passed a couple of years ago, and we just lost the second member of Kool & the Gang in the past 6 months. So that music is foundational, and it always brings a big smile to my face wherever I'm in the world.
Chancellor Robert Jones of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, thank you for taking time to speak with us. I learn so much each time we talk.
Fantastic. Thank you. Can't wait to the launch.
Up next, we'll explore some of the Black arts events in CU. And one young man in Urbana used education to escape a violent childhood. Today, he wants to turn his experiences into lessons for children.
Show them the things that I learned or could have learned, like things that I wish I did differently, and help them stay focused, give them an opportunity to pull them out the streets and clear their minds in different ways.
We'll hear from Shamar Betts when Dialogue on Illinois Soul returns. Year and a half that we were putting together Illinois Soul, we heard from focus groups, and they had one message loud and clear. They wanted to hear more about diverse arts events in Central Illinois. So every week, we're going to let you know what's happening around town.
Play that line for me again. Here we go.
The Krannert Center for the Performing Arts and Illinois Soul bring you the Uncorked series of concerts in celebration of Black History Month. Thursday, February 8th at 5 p.m., listen to Dexter O'Neill and the Funk Yard. Also around town, the Virginia Theater presents The Magic of Motown on Friday, February 9th. The show features 15 vocalists and a band that capture the Motown sound, including tributes to the Jackson 5, Diana Ross and the Supremes, Smokey Robinson, and more. The Bruce D. Nesbitt African American Cultural Center on the U of I campus presents a Love Jones Poetry Night on Thursday, February 13th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Again, all of these events are listed on our website, illinoisoul.org. Thank you for joining us for Dialogue, a new weekly news magazine focused on the Black communities of Central Illinois. I'm Reginald Hartwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Shamar Betts is a young man who had a difficult upbringing. He witnessed horrific violence as a child. Years later, he spent time in prison for inciting a riot in Champaign in the aftermath of George Floyd's death. Today, Shamar is 23 and lives in Urbana, and he's committed to turning his life around. Illinois Student Newsroom's Madison Holcomb reports he hopes to be a positive role model for young people today. And a note to listeners, the story contains descriptions of violence.
When Shamar Betts was a kid, he says his mom worked hard to shelter him. She wouldn't let him hang out with the neighborhood kids or go to the store or to the park alone. She signed him up for activities like chess and band. Shamar says his mother was his best friend. But his mom's life was cut short. She died of a heart attack when Shamar was just 12. They were driving in a car together at the time.
When we approached the red light, she like put it in park, she knew. And she was like holding on me and just saying like she loved me and stuff. Call the police, call the ambulance.
He doesn't remember much from that time other than feeling really depressed. Without his mom, Shamar says he quickly learned why she tried to shelter him. He was walking out of a corner store with a friend one day, and a car sped past. A passenger pulled out a gun and shot into a small crowd of people across the street. He says he watched as 5 or 6 people fell to the ground while the others ran or crawled away.
At that time, like the way it looked, it just seemed like a movie.
Shamar started hanging out with more kids from his neighborhood. He'd watch as they threw rocks at cars and shot Roman candle fireworks at one another. His mom's voice in his head made him want to stay out of trouble. He also realized he had the power to make better decisions.
I have a choice to pick and do what I want and not just survive.
At the end of 7th grade, Shamar and his sister moved to Mississippi to live with their grandmother and aunt. But Shamar struggled to get along with his aunt, and he no longer felt challenged in school. So he moved to Urbana to finish high school. Shamar graduated and got jobs with the Urbana Park District and the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club. He was excited to start college in the fall of 2020. But in May of that year, Shamar, who was 19 at the time, made a decision that would change his life. News of George Floyd being killed by a white police officer in Minneapolis had started to spread. Shamar watched the viral video footage of the killing and was immediately enraged.
My first instinct, selfishly, I guess, was just thinking as a black man, how easy that could have been me, how easy it could have been one of my loved ones.
Shamar attended a peaceful protest in Champaign-Urbana a few days later, but didn't think it had much impact. When his brother in Chicago sent him pictures and videos of riots there, Shamar got an idea. A riot would be more impactful than a peaceful protest. Shamar created a flyer the next day, which contained a photo of a cop car on fire and the words "Riot at Marketplace Mall." He posted it to Facebook and said it received hundreds of shares. He says he got to the mall, gave the A-OK to the crowd, and they began vandalizing and looting stores. Police arrested Shamar a few days later. Sitting in court, he says he realized what he'd done.
After sitting in jail and listening to them bash me so much in court, I realized the wrongness. I realized what I did wrong completely. I realized what I could have did better.
He'd spend the next year in jail, followed by almost 2 years in federal prison. Shamar says he used the time to work on self-improvement and make plans to get his life back on track. He's grateful that 2 months after he got out on probation, he received a call from a man named Tracy Dace. He's the founder and CEO of the local nonprofit Dream, which provides mentorship to young people. Dace says one of Shamar's mentors reached out to him while Shamar was transitioning out of prison. Dace says he saw it as a sign.
I'm a person of faith, and I was like, well, maybe God is trying to tell me something, right, that I need to connect with this young man. And so I'm very happy I did. He's a very intelligent young man, and I've enjoyed working with him.
Dace gave Shamar a job at Dream, where he helped drive kids to and from the after-school program. This year, he's stepping into a new role as an achievement coach, working with fourth and fifth graders. Shamar says he looks up to Dace.
He's actually a big role model to me. He's very involved with the community, very aware of the things that's going on, and actually wants to make a change.
Today, Shamar says he's focused on his goals. He wants to study psychology and become a guidance counselor to mentor kids who grew up in similar situations as he did.
Just try to show them the things that I learned or could have learned, like things that I wish I did differently, and help them stay focused, give them an opportunity, kind of like Mr. Tracy do, to pull them out the streets and clear their minds in different ways.
Shamar says he regrets the harm caused by the riot. But overall, he says he wouldn't change anything about his life.
I don't want to do a replay. I don't want to really change things because each of those situations helped make me who I am, led me to some route that led to another.
I'm Madison Holcomb, Illinois Student Newsroom.
You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Public Media. I'm Reginald Hardwick. As we were building Illinois Soul, many people in Champaign-Urbana urged us to include a dialogue about mental health and how to seek solutions. In future weeks, you'll hear from Black therapists, counselors, psychologists, and other experts to empower you with information about mental wellness. Recently, our friends at the 21st Talk Show, which airs weekdays at 11 a.m. on WILL AM 580, tackled a week of conversations about the fentanyl crisis in Illinois. Included was a dialogue about how to talk to your children about avoiding addiction. Host Brian Mackey talked with Patricia Sykes, prevention supervisor with Alternatives, a behavioral health center in Chicago. Let's listen in to a portion of their conversation.
You know, you've been doing this work for 20 years. When it comes to talking about drugs with people in their teens, what have you learned about, you know, what works, what doesn't work?
I can tell you one thing, what does not work are fear tactics. They just don't work, because what happens then is there's that testing that they go through. Oh, you say this is going to happen to me if I do it? Well, I'm going to try it anyway. Or I know someone who did it and this didn't happen to them. So first and foremost, fear tactics do not work. What works is listening, asking questions. And when we ask the questions, let's take the insinuation that they're doing the drug out of it. Let's try our best to be clear as humanly possible on our intentions when we talk to them. Once they respond to us and give us an answer, there's a good chance they're going to say something we are not comfortable with hearing. So we have to be prepared to hear them and what they're saying. Resist the urge to lecture or preach. And then just let them know that you're there. It's a fine line to walk because you care so much and you know the risks of what could happen if they engage in these dangerous drugs. But you have to be careful. Listen, say as much as need to be said. And again, I cannot stress hearing what they're saying so that they can feel validated. And when they feel validated, believe me, they will then feel like they have the tools to make the necessary changes in their lives, if they so choose.
You know, you're saying, listen to them. I wonder, is it challenging to get people to open up about this stuff? Are they eager to talk about it? Are they rolling their eyes when you first begin this process? How does that look?
They are not eager. They are rolling their eyes. And some of them have even walked out of the classroom. But I cannot stress enough, when we go in with that culture of prevention, establishing those relationships with the administration, staying true to who we are. When they see that you're genuine, then they may not say it, but they will then begin to see that you're telling the truth and buy into it in their own way.
So the organization you work for, Alternatives, you have a big focus mm-hmm. on restorative justice. And I think you mentioned this earlier, culturally relevant approach. What does that mean on a practical level?
On a practical level, it means we are aware of our communities that we serve. We serve basically three communities here in Chicago, the South Side, the West Side of the city, and the North, East, and a little west side of the city. So with those three areas, they are very distinct cultural, ethnic groups. So when we go in, we're aware of that. And our staff is very culturally diverse as well. And applying the restorative justice as well as trauma-informed care, we're aware and educated on the trials, the tribulations, the obstacles each community may go through. Like, say, for instance, on the West Side, it's mainly African American and Latinx. So we are aware that there may be some gang struggles there. Again, drug usage. And then there is the farther north side where there is drug usage, but because that area is known to be a little more financially adept, so their drug of choice may be something more expensive than that they use on the west side of Chicago. And then on the south side of Chicago, on the north side of Chicago, you have a lot of European families there, Polish, Swedish, those types of cultures. And on the south side, it's predominantly African American. So we're aware that each area has its own struggles that they go through, and we adapt our programming to meet the needs of each community. Now, do we do it perfectly every time? No, we don't. But we do our best to stay educated so that we can offer the communities what helps them from a cultural perspective, a cultural lens. We have someone at We have a whole training team at Alternatives. We just had a racial equity training. So not only are we very adept with racial equity, we're adept with trauma-informed care and restorative justice.
What do you think about parents providing substances?
I am so glad that was brought up, because 'tis true, as questionable and as painful as that may be to hear, it can be true. Some parents, what we find too in our communities, they're becoming parents younger and younger, and they may not have been privy to this type of information. And they may be engaged in said drug or drinking alcohol regularly, recreationally. And I've heard this, it's odd, but I promise you I've heard it. I would rather do this with my kid than not know who they're doing it with. So that's some of the knowledge that I'm aware parents engage in with their students, with their children. And we've had students come to school smelling like marijuana because the parents are using it as they're driving their kid to school. So I am aware of this. Although we tap very lightly when we talk to our students about their parents, because there's that bond, you know, you're talking about my mom, you're talking about my dad. So we have to be very careful.
There is a new law that took effect this month, actually, in Illinois, where high school students are going to be required to get education specifically on the dangers of fentanyl use as well as fentanyl contamination. I mean, I'm not going to ask you to get into the specifics of the law, but I mean, do you see that as a positive step?
I have to be honest and say I see it as a positive, and it could possibly become a negative based on how the information is given out. We have to make sure that we provide an arena wherein we listen to the students, and not to judge or lecture them, while at the same time providing the information, the education that they need.
That was Brian Mackey, host of The 21st Show, talking with Patricia Sykes, prevention supervisor with Alternatives, a behavioral health center in Chicago, about how to talk to children about avoiding addiction. Coming up, the first Black trans woman elected to a school board tells us the lesson she's learned.
All of the change, whether it's progressive or not, takes a while to actually be tangible.
NPR's Aisha Roscoe connects us with the personal stories of attending an HBCU.
HBCUs have and continue to make a mark on this world and make the world a better place.
Dialogue from Illinois Soul continues right after this. From Illinois Soul, you're listening to Dialogue, a new weekly news magazine focused on the Black communities of Central Illinois. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. 35 years ago, the great Aretha Franklin sang the theme song to a TV comedy named A Different World.
It's a different world. Ooh, and where it come from?
Now, being a Gen Xer, I remember the antics of Whitley Gilbert and Dwayne Wayne on the fictional historically Black college campus of Hillman. This year, another light is being shined on HBCUs by journalist Aisha Roscoe. If her name sounds familiar, she's the host of NPR's Weekend Edition, which you can hear on Illinois Soul on Sunday mornings.
We're going to turn to the U.S. now, where another temporary spending deal is being prepared to avoid the partial government shutdown that was looming at the end of this week. But some House Republicans...
Or perhaps you've heard or seen her when she was a White House correspondent for NPR. Now she's an author who just published the book, HBCU Made, A Celebration of the Black College Experience. And Aisha joins us now.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm really honored.
You say in your story that you were a good student, but very shy, with few friends before college. How did attending Howard University change you?
Oh my goodness. In so many ways. I was, you know, as you said, I was a very shy, introverted child from Durham, North Carolina. What I did really well was I did school. I could do school. I could do tests. I could write papers. But when it came to like getting to know people and making friends, that was not a strong point. So when I got to Howard, it was very overwhelming. Like I'm away from home. I'm, you know, meeting new people. And, you know, it's the college experience. So people are out and about, they doing things. And I'm like, you know, I felt like I went from riding a tricycle to being in like a Lamborghini and I didn't know how to drive. But what I will say is at Howard, I was able to forge some friendships that remain to this day and make deep connections. I was also able to find a lot of myself. It didn't happen overnight. I didn't all of a sudden, you know, get there and just, you know, have the confidence that I have now. But what I say is that I feel like it really planted seeds. Like I saw the potential. I saw what I could be. I saw what I could do. And it really taught me about what it means to, you know, I like to say to come correct. You know, at Howard, there are very high expectations. And, you know, if you do not come correct, you will get clowned. You know, yes. They want you to show up in the world looking good, but not just looking good, but you got to have the information. You got to be prepared, because if you're caught slipping, people will let you know. You know, you can't just fake it. And so that's what was really instilled in me, that you have to come correct. You gotta be ready and you gotta work hard. And if you do, you can have the confidence in that. And that's what I learned at Howard.
We're in a Big Ten college campus town here in Champaign-Urbana with more than 50,000 students. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience at an HBCU?
Well, I think, and you know, HBCU made, what is the beautiful thing about it is that you see this, that there are all sorts of different experiences. You have a school like Howard, where I went, which is like, you know, medium size, but in a big city. But then, you know, we have other people that went to like, you know, Dillard, which is in New Orleans, but it's like relatively small. We have, you know, people that went to like Talladega College. So like smaller colleges. And then we have also like, you know, a FAMU, which is, you know, very big. And so you have like the wide range of experiences. But what I did find, even though you have all of these wide ranges of experience, is that in each of the stories, really, you can see that there is a community, there's connection, and then there's diversity on the campuses, which I think a lot of people find surprising, because it's like, well, everyone's Black, but, you know, Black people are not monolithic. And so you see over and over in the stories in HBCU made, people talking about coming to these campuses and seeing Black people from all over the world, from all sorts of backgrounds, you know, from, you know, rich people who, you know, summered in Martha's Vineyard, to first time, you know, first generation college students, and, you know, everything in between. And so so you see community, you see a diversity of experience, and you see a lot of resilience. And so that's what I feel like you get specifically on an HBCU campus.
In your book, you write about being the editor of Howard's college newspaper, The Hilltop. You said the pushback on stories viewed as negative was swift and often intense. And as Black journalists, we aim to be fair, but face criticism when reporting on stories that aren't always seen as favorable to the Black community. How have you learned to deal with that criticism?
Well, I talk about this in the book, and what I felt like I learned at Howard was, you know, just because you love something, I feel like if you love something, then you hold it to a high standard. And that's part of what to actually be respectful and loving is to call out things that are not what they should be. And I think, and I say in the book that I totally understand that there are times and many times where the media has been unfair or has not provided the context of why certain things may be, you know, when it comes to Black institutions or Black communities, and that, you know, there has been a tendency of people to kind of swoop in and just focus on the negative. And I never want to do that. But I also think that you have to shine a light on what's true, so that people can make changes, and that to truly love something is to hold it to account. And you see that in some of the other stories, like Michael Arsenault, who also has an essay in the book. He's a Howard grad, New York Times bestselling author, you know, but he's also, you know, a gay Black man. And he talks about some of the struggles that he had on an HBCU campus that wasn't always embracing of the LGBTQ community. And I think that's important, because we have to embrace not just Black people, but all types of Black people, and all, you know, and to understand the fullness of the Black experience.
What do you hope that people get out of the book and reading all the passages from everyone from Oprah to Michael Arsenault, as you just mentioned?
Oh, I hope that people, you know, when they're reading about, like, you know, Roy Wood Jr.'s story or Oprah Winfrey's story or Stacey Abrams' story, I hope that they get the idea that HBCUs have and continue to make a mark on this world and make the world a better place. And so I want to be clear, this book isn't about saying HBCUs are better than predominantly white institutions, but it's about shining a light on the fact that HBCUs play a very special role and a very unique role in this country, and that this world has benefited from them, and that they deserve support, and that they deserve to be recognized and celebrated.
You spent many years covering the White House. How did being at an HBCU prepared for that? Because that wasn't always an easy task.
No, not at all. I mean, I think that, like I said, part of what I feel like going to an HBCU prepared me for was to, first of all, think critically about the world around me, to challenge assumptions. I feel like in my classes, we were definitely taught in every subject, whether it was math, whether it was, you know, economics, to look at things not just from, not this idea of looking at it from a Black perspective, but looking at it in a full range of, you know, like questioning the status quo, questioning what we are always told, and going deeper. What is the context for why things are the way they are? You know, what are the systems in place? And so I feel like that's what I was able to bring to the White House, where I could not just look at what is being said, but okay, how did we get here? What is the context, and how does this fit into the longer story of U.S. history? So I got, you know, so I think I got that. And I also learned a lot about standing my ground, and that, you know, covering the Trump White House, you had to know how to stand your ground, and, you know, and you had to, at times you had to be able to, you know, come back with the follow up. And so I think I definitely got that from HBCU.
Ayesha Roscoe, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday and author of HBCU Made, a celebration of the Black college experience. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Alana Banks made history 2 years ago, becoming the first Black and transgender woman elected to a school board in the country. And that matters to trans people within her Central Illinois School District. Zelda Tindall is trans and an assistant teacher at MacArthur High School in Decatur.
I'm absolutely overjoyed to know that we have somebody on the school board that's fighting for us.
Banks helped appoint a new superintendent for Decatur Public Schools and negotiate a contract that raised wages for assistant teachers. Still, balancing the demands of the communities she represents hasn't been easy. IPM education reporter Emily Hayes explains.
So this is our
cafeteria. This is mainly for like seniors. Uh-huh. They come here and they have lunch. And
I met Alana Banks at her day job at a large social service organization. She's only 28, but in her off hours, she serves on the school board and is starting a shelter for queer youth. She didn't transition until she was 22 and identified as a gay boy while in school.
There have been many situations where I felt, you know, outed by administrators or felt, you know, just unsafe, you know, even walking to class, to and from class.
She never knew what peers would say to her, and now she wants to be the hope for current students like her.
There is the light at the end of the tunnel for students who are struggling with these issues.
Despite her election making national news in 2021, Banks has not received any hate mail. Instead, she says the hardest part of her term has been doing enough for the communities she represents.
Because a part of my campaign, when I first started, everyone assumed that I was just gonna primarily work with Black issues or queer issues. And so those two communities, actually, I wish that I could do more work for. There's just been a whole whirlwind of other things that we've had to focus our attention on.
Like relocating students over the summer when two school buildings in the district were found to be structurally unsound. And that has led to frustration from some in the LGBTQ plus community who feel their issues aren't being addressed quickly enough.
To explain to folks that, you know, unfortunately, in this political climate, you know, nothing happens overnight. All of the change, whether it's progressive or not, takes a while to actually be tangible. So that's kind of the hardest part.
The leaders of Black youth groups are also reaching out for help.
They come to me in that I am African-American and that I should be able to articulate their interests and concerns and things like that. But they struggle with me, my identity.
Those groups are often organized by the same Black churches Banks grew up in. She says they often have an implicit don't ask, don't tell policy about being gay or lesbian and are more hostile to trans people. She often has to fight stereotypes that Black trans women are uneducated, have a mental illness, or are sex workers.
I'm none of those things. I'm actually a professional. I'm working on my degree. I make my own money. I'm self-sufficient. I'm independent. And I think for them to see that, for the community at large to see that, to witness that, that trans people are just as normal as everyone else. It's an adjustment, I guess. But again, being the optimist that I am, I always feel that, you know, it won't always be this way.
In those hard moments, Banks relies on her social circle, including the superintendent and board secretary, who she's known since she was a child.
Our board president is also really great at listening. I can always call on someone if I just need to decompress or vent about it. But other than that, I just tell myself, I'm naturally an optimistic person, so I just tell myself, you know, this too will pass, and tomorrow's a new day. So I think it's just having that optimistic energy about myself is just, that's the best I can do right now.
Alana Banks' term on the Decatur Public School Board ends in 2025, and she's already planning to run again. I'm Emily Hayes with Illinois Public Media.
And that's our first show here on Illinois Soul. Join us for a dialogue every Saturday at 8 a.m. and Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul, FM 101.1 and 90.9 HD2. Our music theme was composed by Lamont Holden. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are brought to you by Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Enjoy the week, and we'll dialogue with you again next week. Thank you.